This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. Thanks for joining us on this Martin Luther King Jr. Day, a day that in recent decades has focused on service and on giving back. A day when people may be thinking about community and their involvement in that community. And so we thought we'd revisit one of our shows from late last year, all about civic engagement. When we hear that term, we often think about voting. But Americans participate in this thing we call a democracy in so many other ways. Because while 7 in 10 Americans report feeling generally negative about what's going on in the country today, we're also more hopeful about solving our problems locally. A majority of Americans say they are optimistic that people in their communities who hold different political views can come together to solve problems, according to the 2018 Civic Engagement Survey. And you're saying the same.
This is Laurie Williams in Austin, Texas. After I retired, I started a refugee ministry 4 years ago at our church.
Hi, I'm Rachel, and I work for a nonprofit called the Humane League, mobilizing volunteers around the country to fight factory farming at an individual level and at a corporate level. I'm from Douglasville, Pennsylvania.
Hi, this is Karen, and I'm calling from Florham Park, New Jersey. I did nothing in the past. Currently, I organize with the local and national anti-racist group. We hold workshops on undoing racism and community organizing, and I am very involved with them.
Hi, this is Nikki from Arlington, Texas. I volunteer at my son's Title I high school, and I have been the vice president of donations for a local 501c3 nonprofit called Starry Night Prom, which holds all expense paid proms for all high school students with significant disabilities in the Arlington, Texas ISD. I'm far more engaged than before.
All this hour, we'll be exploring exactly the type of civic engagement you're describing. Everything from teaching civility at a church in Tennessee.
Let's have a discussion. Let's see if we can be a better community and do things a little bit better.
To turning a library into a space for racial healing.
We do feel that it's our civic duty to provide a space and provide opportunities for our community to come together.
But first, let's explore exactly what civic engagement is, what it looks like, what it sounds like, and where we're seeing it happen. Priya Parker is the founder of Thrive Labs and author of the book The Art of Gathering, How We Meet and Why It Matters. And Holly Russin-Gilman is a lecturer at Columbia University and co-author of the book Civic Power, Rebuilding American Democracy in an Era of Crisis. Holly starts us off by defining what civic engagement actually means.
When I think of civic engagement, I think about a broad set of practices and attitudes of involvement in the social and political life, which converge to increase the health of a democratic society. So I really liked a lot of the examples you guys were just giving, because for me, civic engagement really does extend beyond elections, and it's how people can really exert agency and voice and power in their own communities in ways that help really strengthen our community together.
And there's an idea of thin engagement versus thick engagement. What does that mean in regular language?
It's definitely not totally intuitive. And I think, you know, nomenclature is one of those things that you can ask 10 different people and get 100 different answers. And when I think about thick participation, I think about large numbers of peoples and small groups. So it's sort of that thick interpersonal relationships where you're having very informed, very deliberate engagement. And then I think about thin participation, where you're really activating people as individuals, not necessarily in group identity. It's fast, it's easier. Good examples can include, you know, online petitions, things of that nature. And I think what we're really seeing is that you need a hybrid model. There's no one size fits all for civic engagement, but it's exciting that many people around the country are thinking about new opportunities for really blending what I would call thick and thin participation to think about more creative ways to be involved and engaged.
So at the top of the show, and Priya, I want to bring you in here. We heard that people are feeling negatively about the state of the country, but at the same time, they're feeling really hopeful about creating change in their own communities locally. Why do you think that is, Priya?
We tend to be moved by the people around us, by the people who affect us in our, you know, physical spaces, in our streets, in our grocery stores. And it's a lot easier to, you know, hate or vilify somebody online or through the filter bubble of the news than actually having a living human being breathing in front of you. And so you're starting to see a lot of kind of pop-up thick gatherings, to use Holly's language, where people are trying to say, okay, I want to actually spend time with somebody who doesn't think like me and see what it's actually like to engage them. Because in person, you can't use a, you know, an avatar. You can't leave an anonymous comment. You actually have to say, this is what I think. This is what I believe. And so groups like the Rockbridge Civil Discourse Society in Virginia have decided that they want to come together and have a, you know, pro-Trump and anti-Trump and people from, you know, various political beliefs come together to actually engage in political discourse, but politely, and to see how do we actually build together in our local communities when everything nationally is telling us that we can't.
Well, and I'm also wondering, Priya, to that point, when we're talking about avatars and screen names, I see people doing this all the time, and it's looking at their phones and not looking at each other. And increasingly, every day, that's happening more and more. I'm guilty of it. I know a lot of us are. Are face-to-face meetings and gatherings more important or more effective than doing digital outreach, digital connecting?
It depends on what your purpose is. So every gathering, you know, I study gatherings as a living, and one of the things that we see over and over again is when gatherings are transformative, they know what their purpose is. So an online gathering might be more effective than an offline gathering if your purpose is to mobilize millions of people quickly. However, offline gatherings are much more effective when you have meaningful conversation, when you create a safe space, but very simply, when you look people in the eye. And by the way, in-person gatherings doesn't actually necessarily mean we're looking at each other in the eye. There's been studies that show that over the last 10 years, with the increase of cell phones, the number of times we make eye contact with each other over the course of a minute has gone down to up to 60%. And so there's actually things you need to do, even if you're going to gather in person, to make sure that we're not just still actually doing it through the hallways of the digital sphere.
Well, actually, I taught a course last fall, and I made my students not look at their screens during the class, and some of them, well, we'll let them decide what they thought about that. But I thought it helped engagement. Holly, I want to hear from you. What role do you think technology plays in facilitating or not facilitating engagement? And that's coming on, you know, from each other, between us, and also from the government on to its constituents.
Well, I really agree with what you and Priya have been talking about in terms of different kinds of engagement need different kinds of methods and tools. And I think, you know, you do see that digital technologies are very effective at spreading information quickly, but that does have a caveat that it is easier to spread fake news, as we've seen, and to not have any of that accountability that face-to-face engagement holds. Also, research shows that if you don't have a strong grassroots organizing base, simply doing online and digital engagement and mobilization is going to not actually lead to lasting outcomes. So you need that sort of in-person, strong, grassroots, genuine strategy. And then I think if you combine it with a digital approach, those are kind of the most effective hybrids that we're seeing. But to Priya's point, I think it really does matter what the outcomes are. So when I look at civic engagement, I think a lot about how are we empowering people with decisions? How are we actually giving them an opportunity to have a meaningful say over whether it's their community park, their library, their parent-teacher association, whether it's experiments like participatory budgeting where you hand over a small portion of public dollars to people. There has to be something on the table so that people leave and the civic engagement is an emotionally satisfying experience. And I think that's really more important than what tool you're using.
Priya, you wanted to weigh in on that.
I think that part of what we're talking about here is how do you actually rebuild our civic fabric? And part of that is meaningful decision-making, as Holly was talking about. But part of that can be coming together over and over again for reasons that aren't political. Sometimes it's easier to see this in more extreme contexts in other societies. One of the most interesting studies that I've read was a 2002 study by the political scientist Ashutosh Varshney. He was studying why certain villages in India were affected by riots, both Muslim and Hindu villages. And what he found was the villages where there were strong social, economic, and civic relationships, even when what he called a spark would kind of you know, potentially rile up people within those villages, those are the places that did not end up in violence. Those are the places where the social fabric was strong, even if there was some tension within a community. When their lives were interdependent with one another, they resisted the violence that affected neighboring villages. And so similarly, one of the things that has been interesting right now is there are more and more groups mobilizing kind of politically, postcard parties to make sure people are voting, Sunday suppers, Friday meatball dinners in Philadelphia to kind of rally the base, if you will. The more interesting insight is that a lot of the groups that matter over time in terms of our civic fabric don't always meet for political ends. I was recently speaking with Scott Heiferman, the founder of Meetup, and Meetup has seen a decline in people wanting to necessarily want to come across the aisle together. However, when groups come together for other reasons, so there's a group in Florida called the Beautiful Brown Girls. They weren't a political group, but they started to have this sort of social fabric together that over years, once something happened in the country, they began to become more politically focused, in part because they had these trusted relationships in a completely different context.
And Holly, I'm wondering what you think of that. Like, is that a necessary connector in order for us to be able to move forward?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we need, you know, there's this idea, the Sherry Ornstein idea of the ladder of civic participation. I also think about a conveyor belt model. I think rebuilding the civic and social fabric is an essential building block. And I think there's another opportunity in addition to that, sort of an additive function, to think about how you take those strong civic, social, and communal ties and then how you enhance the public sector and how you make government more representative, more inclusive. And that, to me, is sort of some of the research that I've been looking at. And we're seeing also in local government a lot of energy and innovation in terms of thinking about more opportunities for different voices to have a say and have a meaningful say in decision making. And that's an exciting trend that I think we're going to see continue. And to me, it's sort of complementary in terms of what an ecosystem of civic engagement looks like. For example, just completed some research in Philly with my colleagues at New America, and we were looking at the opportunity of leveraging the soda tax and then putting those dollars back into the community. And so through philanthropic matching investment, you're seeing people volunteering in their parks, their recreation centers, in their libraries. They're hosting pizza dinners to get previously unrepresented voices into the conversation.
Similar to what Priya was just mentioning with the meatball 100%. Dinners and all these other. Well, I've got to say we're up on the end of the segment now, but I want to thank you both. Holly Russom Gilman is a lecturer at Columbia University and co-author of the forthcoming book Civic Power, Rebuilding American Democracy in an Era of Crisis. Holly, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Priya Parker is a conflict resolution facilitator, author of the recent book The Art of Gathering, How We Meet and Why It Matters. Priya, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, stories of civic engagement playing out across the country, and we hear your stories all this hour. It's our MLK Day special. Stay with us. Decades ago, the Saturday morning cartoon lineup included one show with a distinct purpose.
I'm just a bill. Yes, I'm only a bill. And I'm sitting here on Capitol Hill. Well, it's a long, long journey to the capital city.
Schoolhouse Rock gave kids lessons on math, grammar, science, and even civics. The show aired for the last time in 1996, but its goal of creating a fun, engaging way to teach young people about government is still relevant. And now, a high school just north of New York City is taking a similar approach to teaching civics to its students, minus the cartoons, of course.
It's a four-year program. So that really is giving students the time to develop both the skills and the knowledge and to practice taking action in a very authentic way. I think that's honestly the best way for students to learn. It has to be more than just textbooks and lectures about, you know, the branches of government and the nuts and bolts of government.
That's government teacher Joseph Liberty from Mamaroneck High School. After the 2016 election, Liberty launched the original Civic Research and Action program at his school, a hands-on approach that teaches students how they can be critically involved in their local community. I sat down with Liberty and one of his students, Simon Wirth, a sophomore who's in his second year of the four-year program. Liberty brought me back to the program's start.
So the inspiration for this program really began, I'd say, back in 2012. When I was teaching a government course, an AP government course, I began to get my students involved in campaign work at the local, state, and federal levels. And after taking students up to New Hampshire for the presidential primary in 2012, I just began to see how effective that type of work could be on students in terms of sort of giving them a greater sense of sort of efficacy. And I started to think, you know, how can I do more of this? And I began to sort of sketch out plans that eventually turned into what is now Original Civic Research in Action.
Now, how many students are participating in the program currently? How long has it been in existence?
So the program just started last year. I had about 30, a little over 30 students in the year one program, which meets before school twice a week from 7 to 7:45. And then those students continued on to year two, which we now meet during the regular school schedule.
So these are students going in at zero period, essentially.
Yeah, they're coming at zero period and they're getting no credit and no grade, but they have to satisfy year one in order to move into year two, which then becomes a credit-bearing elective.
So, Simon, explain to me, this is an optional program for students. It started, at least last year, at zero period, 7 a.m. It's called the Original Civic Research and Action Program. Why did you want to sign up for this?
Well, that's a great question. I think the biggest thing for me is that this course would help me have a better sense of our community. Mr. Liberti last year held a meeting kind of explaining what this class was. And so many kids with their parents kind of went to a room and Ms. Liberti kind of explained what the course was. And I think I was very first interested to kind of learn about what local government did here. Because, you know, before ever really being in this course, I couldn't really tell you anyone who was in local government, what it did for me, how it really affected my life. So I think that was one of the really most intriguing things that brought me to this course. And then also my mom works for the town and she knows a lot about this stuff. And I think part of, you know, her line of work brought me into this course.
So, Simon, are there particular issues that you've been looking at since you've been taking the course?
Yeah, for sure. One thing, part of this class has been looking at interviews that we've conducted through local stakeholders. And so our class as a whole found, I think, a couple major things that really popped out to us, which was parking in the town, local business, and flooding.
Flooding is an issue.
Yes. Actually, there's many flood zones throughout the town of Amerenek and the village that highly affect the water quality when it all drains out, to getting baseball fields and soccer fields and football fields all ready after they get drenched. It has become a major problem in our town.
Joe, in teaching this class, what do you think is the value of the hands-on approach that Simon's describing versus sitting in a room and being lectured?
Well, I think this type of hands-on work is so important to really helping build what I would say is civic capacity and sort of self-efficacy before they even reach the voting age. So by getting them outside of the classroom, it's a chance for them to really develop the knowledge of the community and providing them with opportunities to sort of practice and fail and succeed within sort of public square. So in that sense, it's a much more organic way of understanding sort of civic action, if you will, in a way that's very real for them and really sort of empowers them in a way that I don't think can be done as well when you're confined to four walls.
And also, we're in a very particular moment. There are very strong feelings on many sides of the political divide. Joe, what do you see as your responsibility, perhaps more broadly, as a social studies teacher in this moment?
Well, I think schools play such an important role and always have and need to within sort of civic education. I think it's important as a social studies teacher to not only help students understand their rights and responsibilities, but really, as my program is trying to do, help students see themselves as change agents at the local level. There's been so much attention, I think, to the national level, and yet local government is so integral to our lives, and yet it's often the least understood.
And Simon, you're 15 years old, right?
Yes.
So you won't be able to vote yourself until a couple of years from now, about 3 years from now. Do you feel like this program is giving you a better understanding of what Mr. Liberty just said as far as, you know, understanding issues at the local level and maybe even preparing you to be a better informed voter in the next couple of years?
Yeah, 100%. I think while no one particularly in this class can vote because they're not of age, I think what it's doing to us is that it's allowing us to understand politics in a better way so that we can now distinguish one candidate from another by looking at their policies, what their views are, rather just seeing him versus him or him versus her or her versus her. And I think that will really help everyone who's taking this class to form their own opinions and see elections in a more informed way so that they can actually feel like their vote is going to turn something that they believe in rather than just kind of blindly voting with your party or something that a lot of people do when they don't really know the policies of each candidate.
Joseph Liberty is a government teacher from Mamaroneck High School, and Simon Wirth is a sophomore participating in the original Civic Research and Action Program at the school. Thank you both for joining us.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
We're talking about civic engagement. When you hear that phrase, what does it make you think about? Maybe those calls to action that we've heard again and again?
Make a phone call to your senator or representative's office.
Call your rep right now.
Call your senator.
Call our congressman.
Your voice is important.
Send a letter, make a phone call, or record a video, and tell your congressman what you think.
But do most Americans actually do that? And if they do, does it work? What about going to protests or attending town halls or just plain showing up at your local government official's office? Do any of those things make a difference? Because it does seem like we're doing a lot more of it every day. In fact, according to a Washington Post and Kaiser Family Foundation poll, 1 in 5 Americans has protested in the streets or participated in a political rally since the start of 2016. And nearly 20% of them had never protested before. And it doesn't end in the streets.
What we're seeing is tremendous. To give you one data point, one Senate office we worked with saw a 900% increase in constituent communications compared to the year earlier.
That's Bradford Fitch. He's the president and CEO of the nonprofit Congressional Management Foundation. And they track how constituents communicate with Congress as a measure of civic engagement.
There's one congressional district that we were able to look at and found that in 2001, they got 9,400 emails and letters. Fast forward to 2017, and that same congressional district got 123,000 emails and letters. That's a dramatic increase, more than tenfold increase in constituent engagement over that 16-year period.
That's a lot of letters and emails. And what effect is that actually having? Fitch says it has its limits.
Most people are engaged in what we'll call clicktivism. They'll get an email from an association or nonprofit they belong to that says, send this message to Capitol Hill, and they do it, and that's all they do. And that's a disappointment and also a real missed opportunity because citizens, if they did a little more, like individualizing that email and talking about how their family or their business or their trade group is affected in their community, that's what members of Congress are looking for when they interact with citizens.
What about tweeting or using Facebook to connect with your senator or congressperson?
Social media is actually a truly effective form of interacting with lawmakers. The ones that are on Twitter and Facebook are monitoring their feeds very carefully. And one of the most effective ways is to react to something the legislator has done. For example, if they make a speech on the floor and they put that on their Twitter feed or their Facebook page, if you react to that, our research shows is just a handful of people, a couple dozen people saying the same message is definitely going to be something that the office pays attention to.
And then there's face-to-face interaction. In 2017, members of Congress held more than 800 town hall meetings. Some of them even sparked viral political moments.
No, I do not believe that health care is a basic right.
Before 2016, an average of 20 to 30 people might have shown up at a town hall. In 2017, the average attendance was 242 people. Today, lawmakers are holding fewer in-person town halls. But Fitch says technology is paving the way for people to still make their voices heard.
We've been tracking telephone town hall meetings and online town hall meetings in the last 10 years, and that holds a great degree of promise for having a more robust and interactive engagement. I mean, the average number of people in a telephone town hall meeting now is between 3,000 and 5,000 people. You could, in today's day and age, actually have an entire congressional district on a common internet platform watching the member of Congress, taking online polls. There's some really interesting things that technology does offer that just simply was not available a few years ago.
But perhaps the biggest lesson in all this is that engaged constituencies are an essential part of democracy.
I have to quote Thomas Jefferson, who said, "We in America do not have a government by the majority. We have a government by the majority who participate." Whether it's voting or writing members of Congress or writing letters to the editor, in our democracy, the tool of accountability that citizens have to keep their elected officials accountable is their own activity, is their engagement.
That was Bradford Fitch, the president and CEO of the Congressional Management Foundation. What role does the public library serve in your community?
People come to us for help. I think it's important not just to do the bare minimum for society, but also strive to give people good things in life as well.
That's Andrew Fairweather, a senior librarian at the Seward Park Library on Manhattan's Lower East Side. Librarians like Fairweather say they strive to serve the needs of their communities, but from city to city, those needs are different. In Nashville, Tennessee, as the Black Lives Matter movement was growing across the country, librarians noticed a growing demand within their community for honest conversations around race. Andrea Blackman is the director of the Civil Rights Room at the Nashville Public Library, and she joined me to explain how her library has facilitated conversations on racial justice for the Nashville community.
The program has been in existence for 4 years now, and some of the attendees include local law enforcement, new police recruits, our statewide law enforcement agencies. We also have designed a program specifically for students, K through 3, higher ed, high school students, corporations, and just the community at large. Anyone who's willing to come together to look introspectively and ask some tough questions of ourselves about race, around issues of equity, around issues of justice and cultural sensitivity and awareness using the lens of Nashville civil rights movement.
What does a typical session in this project look like or sound like?
The typical session, as the attendees walk into the physical civil rights room, there is a replica of a lunch counter. So it takes you back to 1950 and 1960. They're oversized black and white images of sit-in participants and local leaders and segregationists, agitators and bystanders and activists. So the participants come in and they sit down at this lunch counter. And then our staff are able to lead conversations asking questions such as, you know, looking at this image of John Lewis being dragged off his stool at a lunch counter, asking questions like, what do we assume is going on? How do we verify and disprove those assumptions? We're asking our participants to give us their viewpoints, to give us their perspectives, all doing this hard introspective work with the idea of race and equity at the forefront of that conversation.
And, you know, I'm wondering, we've had a very difficult 2 years in this country. I think that on either side of the political divide, there have been many conversations, many things that the country is really grappling with. Have the conversations in this program also evolved in the past 2 years?
Yes, they have. They have. They've evolved to mirror what's going on in society. And we have seen that happening. You know, we launched our program in April of 2015, exactly after the death of Walter Scott when he was murdered. We continued to push our programs after the Sandra Bland incident and Philando Castile. We had public programs. And so our public and our participants, their conversations are shifting. You know, for example, we have an image in the civil rights room of a local attorney. His house was bombed in 1960. And when new recruits or community members look at that image now, their minds automatically turn and shift. In their own words, they ask, well, that was an act of terrorism in 1960. And what does that look like today for us?
And we're really looking in the hour today on the show, we're looking at the ways that Americans are trying to have more civic engagement, and whether that means libraries, calling their congressperson, volunteering, many different ways. What do you see, Andrea, as the role that libraries can play in community engagement today?
We take on the premise that it's our civic duty to provide a space and provide opportunities for our community to come together outside of this ongoing divide and echo chamber that we see in national politics, that we see on social media. The public library, and particularly what we've done here at NPL, we have been a space to convene people together to have these courageous conversations. And we do feel that that's the role of the public library.
Andrea Blackman is the director of the Civil Rights Room at the Nashville Public Library. Thanks so much, Andrea.
Thank you.
Now we ask, does this moment of vigorous civic engagement extend to giving and philanthropy? According to Giving USA, in 2017, Americans gave more than $400 billion to charity. 70% of that $400 billion came from individuals.
It's quite big. It's bigger than some countries' GDP. So it's a significant sum, and Americans are very charitable.
That's Stacey Palmer. She's the editor of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. And she spoke with me about who exactly is giving away that money, where they're donating it, and why they choose to give.
One of the things that there's always been a concern about is that it basically is consistent with the economy. So Americans always give 2% of income. It's not creeping up in any way. So we're not motivated to give even more of our income. It's a sign that the economy is doing well.
And are more people giving, or is it less people giving and they're giving more money?
That actually is the really important question. There's been a significant drop in the number of Americans who give. The share of Americans who donate to charity has dropped by 11 percentage points over the past decade. So fewer and fewer people are giving. Those who are giving very big sums. So we see the very wealthiest in this country giving in just staggering sums. You'll see $300 million gifts being made. So the wealthy are giving very much, but the middle class, they're cutting back on their giving.
And that was going to be my next question. If they're not giving to the traditional charities in the way that we might think and define philanthropy, are Americans giving in other ways? Are they giving through, and I think this is something we see a lot, GoFundMe accounts or social media accounts that folks set up for their healthcare, for example? Are we trying new ways of giving?
Absolutely. That one-to-one giving, feeling like I'm going to go help you pay your medical bill, that feels more fulfilling to a lot of people than giving to a charity where you're not sure where the money's going, who it's helping, those kinds of things. So we do believe that a lot of money that people typically would have given to charity is going to these crowdfunding sites. It's hard to trace them. There aren't great statistics, but it definitely seems that that's probably diverting some of the money that would have otherwise gone to charity.
So in terms of the wealthy who are giving more, who are they giving to?
Wealthy people tend to give to colleges, hospitals, scientific research. They give to their own foundations. Many of them set up their foundations. We all know about Priscilla Chan and Mark Zuckerberg setting up a big foundation and another enterprise that gives money to socially oriented businesses and to advocacy groups. They've pledged most of their wealth to that cause. So the wealthy are giving, but they're probably not giving quite as much to local social services, local groups. That's probably a smaller portion of their giving.
Have we, you know, when I think about what you just said in terms of the social services and other more local groups, when I think about how more middle-class Americans are giving or not giving as much as they were, I wonder if Americans are trying to sort of fill a giving gap, or they're feeling that they have to fill this giving gap that the government isn't filling.
That's one of the interesting things to watch, is to see whether people realize that their donations make a difference and whether they know that the $50 contribution to the food bank really is very necessary. And I'm not sure we've quite seen that yet. Groups like United Way, for example, saw a very big drop in giving. They're still the biggest charity in the country. People support them very generously, but the amounts that they're giving are smaller. So that means people are cutting back on the amount they give to some of these local groups that provide vital services. So I'm not sure we've seen the connection between what's going on with government and what's going on with charity.
And where does political giving fit into the picture? Because we hear so much about super PACs and getting money out of government. And then there's this other narrative, which is, you know, a lot of these campaigns, you know, tout the fact that they were supported by, quote unquote, smaller donors and individual Americans giving $20 here and $10 there. Is that actually true?
Political giving is fairly different than charitable giving. And so I think, you know, both of those things are true. One of the things that people who study charity say is that while people do give generously in elections, that doesn't shift charitable giving. So you might think, you know, you hear all this money pouring into campaigns and that's hurting charities. And we don't think that there's any evidence of that. If people are engaged, they probably try to do something to give to both. So they might make one of those $50 contributions to a local candidate and give to charity. And one of the things we really saw after the election was something called rage giving after the 2016 election. Groups like Planned Parenthood, ACLU, those kinds of organizations immediately saw an increase in gifts before they could even ask for them. People were giving very generously.
So, you know, we had a call. We asked our listeners to tell us about the different ways that they were giving and how they were engaging in their community. And I want to play you a call that we got from a listener called Willie.
Willie Dickerson, Snohomish, Washington. I feel very much a part of my community as a volunteer with Results, working to end hunger and poverty. I see both the local and the state and national and world situation, and I believe this is the time we can end hunger and poverty and disease. So let's get together and do this.
Your thoughts on that, Stacey. Does Willie sort of represent what you think a lot of Americans feel about this feeling of let's just do this, let's take it into our own hands and fix our problems?
Absolutely. And the important thing he talked about was that he's volunteering. So people are giving their time to causes that they care about. They're looking for results. When they volunteer, they see that there are groups that are making a difference. Those kinds of people are the ones that power charitable giving because they see people in their communities who are suffering, who need help, and then are getting it from charity. So those are the kinds of great examples that when people get engaged and involved, they can feel really good about the impact of their donations. It's those people who don't see the impact that probably are withholding their gifts.
Stacey Palmer is the editor of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. Stacey, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So let's finish today with a little real talk. In practice, all this civic engagement can be pretty hard if people can't find common ground. And who's supposed to step in when the government can't bridge the gap? Well, sometimes it's religion.
We on Signal Mountain, a small community, we've had some difficulties on the local level. Such as we had a box grocery store wanting to get zoning to come up onto the mountain, and that just created a whole lot of controversy.
That's Bill Steverson of Signal Mountain, Tennessee, a small town outside of Chattanooga.
What we realized and what we saw was that the conversation, both with the government and with the general public, was getting rather nasty. And we had never done that before. We've always had disagreements, but what we were seeing was nastiness.
Bill is a member of St. Timothy's Episcopal Church in Signal Mountain, and when he learned that the national arm of the church had developed a curriculum on civic discourse, he had an idea.
Then we saw this curriculum and said, let's have a discussion. Let's see if we can be a better community and do things a little bit better. And we did, and we think it worked well.
I spoke with Bill about why he thinks the courses helped his community, along with Alan Yarborough, the communications coordinator for the Episcopal Church's Office of Government Relations. He helped develop the curriculum.
At the heart of the curriculum and of the concept is really the golden rule. It's treating others as we would want to be treated. And that means listening to other people as we would want to be listened to, and allowing others to speak, I think, requires a certain humility and the understanding that we may have something to learn. And it's the curriculum helps people explore that and explore listening to others, why it's important. And of course, civil discourse is applicable in any number of situations, but the curriculum itself applies that particularly to public policy and the work of advocacy and having conversations around political issues.
Bill, I'm wondering, do you think the nastiness, you said you'd never seen that before, what do you think was creating that? What do you think got people to that point?
Well, I can speculate and you can speculate and I guess anybody could. I learned a whole lot from these forums and one of the first things I learned was that the people who attended, and it was a cross-section of our community, they didn't seem to want to go back and say what's caused it. They didn't want to do that because they realized it would point fingers. What I was wonderfully surprised to hear was that they wanted to say, how do we move forward? How do we solve this problem rather than how do we point blame for the problem?
And Alan, how do you, as someone who developed the curriculum, how do you do that? What are some of the ways to bring people together where you can solve problems even though folks are really feeling strongly on either side?
You know, I think the churches and you know, perhaps the Episcopal Church in particular is uniquely placed for this type of work. The Episcopal Church is fairly diverse in terms of its political party representation of its members. And it's our church communities are places where folks interact face-to-face. And I think sometimes we've lost a lot of opportunities to interact with face-to-face with one another, and that helps humanize our interactions. And, you know, churches are, they're a place to come both for healing, but also to sort of go out and heal. And that includes helping people have conversations with one another. It includes speaking out on public policy issues and helping to foster a richer and deeper way of thinking about those issues.
Bill, you've described being able to help the community work through some issues. Is there anything that you would want to share with other folks who are struggling to maintain civil discourse in their own communities, whether they're within the church or not?
Well, and Alan made this point, and I think it's important, and it's another one of the things that I learned at several points during the conversations, and we had these meetings over a period of 4 weeks. Many people said, we need to continue these type of conversations. We just can't end them. And stupid me, I say, well, why don't we start a Facebook page? And I got shouted down, and I got told, hey, we need to have these conversations face-to-face. The social media serves its purpose, but it doesn't serve a purpose for encouraging civil discourse on a local level. And that was interesting to me, and I think it was important. So the challenge that we've got now is how to continue it through the community, but it's a good challenge to have.
It's fascinating how you both mentioned face-to-face interaction. That's something that I'm wondering how you can use those interactions and how you sort of use that to communicate to folks on the other side. Like, what is it that's so different that happens in person versus what could happen otherwise on social media, for example?
It's easy with social media, and this is perhaps true whether it's a political conversation or not, to sort of put up almost an alter ego or put up a front or a face that may not be our genuine selves. And then sometimes we're kind of in that mode and interacting with other people who've also done that. And it really removes some of the humanity, the common humanity and common experience that we have with each other. And I think that makes it easier to disregard someone else or disregard the experience that they share or why they hold a particular viewpoint. Whereas face-to-face interactions, you know, you have nonverbal communication, which is a huge piece of communication. You have the person's face right in front of you. You can see them. You can watch their reactions. You can really have a richer sense of sort of the passion and how genuine the person is in their interactions. And I think that makes a lot of difference, especially when talking about issues that can be contentious and have significant consequences.
And you've both said that one of the most important things is to acknowledge or get to people to realize that they have shared values and that that's a big part of the curriculum. But how do you do that? It feels like these days we're really living in a very polarized society. How do you get people to realize their shared values? Bill?
One of the exercises that Alan's curriculum had is just to list what you think your values are. And then what we did is we had the group to list what they think the person who has the opposite opinion on a on a subject or the opposite political opinion, what their values are. And what we saw is that we have shared values. And if you can start the conversation through those shared values, you can have a good conversation. You can have an argument, but you can have a good conversation and still have it respectfully and civilly.
Bill, Alan, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bill Steverson is a member of St. Timothy's Episcopal Church in Signal Mountain, Tennessee, and Alan Yarborough is the communication coordinator for the Episcopal Church's Office of Government Relations. And we've been hearing from you about how you're getting civically engaged.
This is Elizabeth. I'm from Minneapolis. I am on the Board of Trustees of my undergraduate college. I'm also involved in an advisory board at my graduate school. Education is so important in our lives. Education is the key to democracy.
My name is Anne-Marie Lax, calling from Charlotte, North Carolina. I am definitely more engaged in my local community. Besides volunteering at a local senior facility with my therapy dog, I have also become quite involved with my local congressional campaign. And instead of just phone banking, I decided to conquer my fears and try canvassing for the midterm election. Going really well and makes me feel like I have some power to create change in this horrible political climate.
That's our show for today. Remember, you can weigh in anytime on anything you hear on the show by giving us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or finding us on Facebook or Twitter. Thanks so much for joining us on this Martin Luther King Jr. Day. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.